funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What movies are on your must-see list this year? Hollywood banks a lot of cash in the lucrative holiday season, and studios also tend to release the films they see as the best candidates for Academy Award nominations. Joining us to talk about what they think is worth seeing in the theater, worth waiting for on home video, and best avoided altogether, we have our go-to team of film critics. Christopher Kelly writes about arts and entertainment for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Chris Wagner for the Dallas Morning News, and Stephen Becker for KERA's Art and Seek. Guys, it's always a pleasure. Welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having us.
So I'll just start with a general question. How good would you say this season is overall as compared with the past few years we've talked about movies?
I'll be a curmudgeon. I think it's been a bad year, and I think thus far from what I've seen, I think it's been an underwhelming Christmas season.
I don't think it's been that bad a year so far, and there's still a couple movies I haven't seen, but it seems like we say it's a bad year every year.
Isn't that part of the job?
That's yeah, it is.
I need to start keeping track of this.
We are curmudgeons, I suppose. But the last few days I've been thinking I've been in my mind trying to whittle down my top 10, and it's hard. There are a lot of things that won't make it that probably should make it. I'll probably have a pretty stocked honorable mention list this year.
And there really are about three or four more things that have yet to come out that really nobody has seen that I think maybe this season's going to kind of hinge on whether or not those things turn out to be good or not.
Okay, so I know a couple of you wanted to talk about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and now it turns out that if you do, you will be killed in the night? What's the story here?
Scott Rudin will smite us.
You actually receive a dragon tattoo if you speak.
Yes, in the middle of the night.
So there's an embargo on the film.
There is an embargo, which was rather famously broken this week by The New Yorker and caused a big kerfuffle. I think it was the definition of the word kerfuffle within the film critic community.
Very kerfuffly.
So Chris and I saw it on Monday, but I'm not sure we can do hand signals and sort
I've
of
never,
express
I've never heard of it. I'm not sure what you're talking
about. Let me just
about.
Say this. Typically, when these embargoes come out and they are strictly enforced, it means the film is not so very good because who wouldn't love advance notice if their film is great?
I think in this case it's a question of them trying to really create this sense of excitement and fervor about it, and kind of they waited till the very end of the season. It's one of the last films to screen for critics, for anyone. So I think they were hoping to really kind of create this moment for it, and so that's probably why the embargo was there. Without giving too much away, I don't think they should be embarrassed to show the movie by any means.
I can't either confirm or deny that.
Well, I think the interesting thing going on here, not to get too inside baseball, but if this were a news story, let's say, and a news outlet had broken an embargo and ran the story, once the embargo is broken, it's broken.
Katie barred the door for everybody
else. Yeah, then it's like free-for-all for everyone. So my question with this is, when a review embargo is broken, does that then open the door for other reviewers to start giving their opinion?
Yeah, theoretically, but everyone's afraid of Scott Rudin and Sony. Scott Rudin's the producer of the film, who basically told David Denby that he could no longer see any movies that he produced. I'm of two minds about this. I think if you enter a theater having agreed to an embargo and you break that embargo, you messed up. And I think there's probably some price to pay for that. On the other hand, the studios use us as their marketing adjunct when they see fit. And if a critic says something good about your movie a little bit earlier than everybody else, it seems like a bit of an overreaction to me.
But on the other hand, I think there's such a rush to like be the first to say, I saw The Dragon Tattoo and this is what it is. And I felt that this year with The Tree of Life. There was this crazy rush the day they started screening that to put out the definitive opinion. And it's so much noise, you know. I'm almost on team embargo. I mean, it's like let the movie come out, you know. Let the critics say what they're going to say. Let the audience see it. Why does there have to be such a rush to kind of judge these things?
Although it is kind of interesting that this is happening with a movie that so many people have read the book.
Everybody
or
over
possibly
the age of 15.
Seen the original movie version, which was filmed in Swedish. And so, yeah, it's not like this is some big story that nobody knows what happens in it.
I hear Lisbeth Sandler's a guy in this one.
Well, I'll find out next week.
Okay, so Christopher Kelly, your movie of the year is Shame.
It's Shame. Boy, that makes me sound strange.
Pervert.
The only NC-17 we've ever discussed on this show.
The first major NC-17 release since Less Caution, I think, was the last big one in 2007. And this is a film directed by the British artist Steve McQueen, whose previous film was Hunger, about the IRA terrorist Bobby Sands. This one is about a sex addict played by Michael Fassbender and his sister played by Carey Mulligan. It is unforgiving and painful to watch and not sexy despite the topic, but I thought he plugged into what's going on in the world right now, the sense of dislocation, alienation, anxiety. It's a movie you kind of watch with a knot in your stomach, and it says a lot more than – it says a lot about the way people are living right now, I think, and that's its feat. It's about a sex addict, but it's also sort of about how we all live and fail to communicate, and it's bruising and beautiful, beautifully shot. Fassbender performance of the year. I was over the moon for this movie.
Yeah, as much as I hate to agree with Chris too much, I love Shame too. It's mm-hmm. just, I don't know if it's my movie of the year, but it's way, way up there for me. It's just so cinematic. It's so purely visual. There's a story there, but there's not a lot of talking being done to tell that story. The performances and the images sort of say it all. And yeah, it is in its own way sort of a very dark zeitgeist movie about the city, New York specifically, but it resonates. It's a much different movie than, say, Taxi Driver, which is one of the great movies about being adrift in New York in this, you know, sort of soulless place. Not that New York is a soulless place, but in these sort of visions of the big city today, it comes off that way. And I left the theater very much shaken by that vision. And Fassbender is just outstanding.
It uses – oh, I'm sorry, Stephen. But it uses to the New York point, it uses a rendition of New York, New York, the classic Liza Minnelli song by Carey Mulligan that is slowed down to excruciating.
It's the slowest version of that song
you'll
ever hear.
It must go on for about 5 minutes. And I thought that was the scene that kind of gives away the goose of the movie. It really is about how the promise of the bright lights have turned a little rotten and sour. And it's such a beautiful scene. It leaves the Michael Fassbender character in tears, and I started tearing up. And it's so cinematic. It's, as Chris said, it's just a striking, striking vision.
And it also really left me thinking about the importance of actors and directors working together multiple times, because you can. This is a movie that really requires a high level of trust between actor and director, because the director is asking the actor to do a lot of things that most actors probably would not do on screen. And they work together, as Chris said previously, in this movie, Hunger, where Fassbender had to lose like 60 pounds or something obscene for that. And they've already said that they have their next movie is already lined up. And so they're kind of developing a, I don't know if you want to say, you know, Scorsese-De Niro or Scorsese-DiCaprio kind of relationship. And I think those things really pay dividends down the line when you work with someone multiple times, as these two have.
Well, since you brought up Scorsese, we should talk about Hugo, which is, by the way, probably the only movie that I've seen because I got a lot going on. And
that's really funny because it's the only movie that none of us have seen.
None of you have seen it. Okay.
I will confess, I was determined to do as much homework as I could before the show, and I went to see it yesterday, and the theater was a tad overheated, and Chris was a tad sleepy, and off I went into La La Land. But what I saw I thought was really lovely, but it's not enough to quite form a critical judgment. it's interesting because it's a movie about nostalgia, and I think that's kind of the topic of the year this year. You know, Hugo's about a boy who ends up crossing paths with an old filmmaker, Georges Méliès, played by Ben Kingsley, and The Artist is about the silent film era, and Midnight in Paris is a movie that engages completely with nostalgia and that question, and The Muppets is about kind of
well, even my week with Marilyn.
My Week with Marilyn.
I mean, this is very much a year for movies about movies.
And movies, I think, that are questioning our need for nostalgia. And I think that really is obviously a function of the larger kind of cultural economic circumstances. I think in moments of real anxiety, you start seeing these movies about nostalgia. What I like about especially Midnight in Paris, they're really kind of inquiries into the limits of nostalgia and whether or not it's even a good thing.
So. Yeah, I mean, Midnight in Paris, which came out months ago now, but will probably be an Oscar contender, has that great sort of, you know, any place or time that you're not living in is probably better sort of feel to it, which is sort of the definition of nostalgia. I should say that I didn't avoid Hugo. It just kind of fell in a week where I had a bunch of stories due, and I know I'm going to see it before I do my top 10, and I don't miss Scorsese, so I'll see it, I promise.
Well, the one thing I'll say, we brought our kids and they enjoyed it, but it really, really doesn't feel like a kid's movie to me. And the Sacha Baron Cohen element, I don't know how much you slept.
I saw a little bit of that.
Chris Kelly, but it felt like a weird addition to me.
It seemed to me, and again, I really kind of missed the first half, but it did seem to me a movie about Scorsese's love of movies, mm-hmm. and especially in the Ben Kingsley character. I don't know how that resonates with a larger audience, and I think the box office has kind of sort of bared that out. It's doing well, but not quite, you know, blockbuster numbers.
So. Doesn't measure up to the critical opinion. Those of us who are steeped in movies all the time, I think, are sort of drawn to this like a magnet. Because it's about the silent era, and it's
yeah,
about
I wanted,
this romantic
and that's
love
the art. I mean, that, I think the artist, which I just saw. I mean, it just saw last night.
This is the silent movie that's out now,
movie.
Black
yeah.
and white and silent.
I feel like it's kind of critics driving that train. That didn't feel to me a movie that a mass audience would particularly care about. It's really just about movies. It's about the filmmaker's love of the silent era and silent giving way to sound, and it's a real kind of fetish object. You know, he brilliantly recreates a silent film right down to the aspect ratio, the music. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful recreation of what those silent movies represented, but I don't know if it's about much more than movie love. You know, that's its subject.
It's a pretty accessible fetish object as a fetish object. It's got a love story in it. For instance, it's got a dog.
A great dog.
Dog system. That dog should get an Oscar nomination.
Is that another nostalgia film, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the reason people are responding to it is it's a kind of highbrow comfort food. You know, it makes intellectuals feel like they it's flattering in some ways. You know, I mean, it kind of flatters people's kind of highbrow tastes, and that's what probably people are looking for in this era of uncertainty. And to get back to Shame, to repeat what I loved about Shame, it's so unsettling. It's mm-hmm. the opposite of that, and it's so of the moment. And it's so not about nostalgia. There's an interesting tension there.
But I wonder with the artist, can you have a nostalgia? Can that be nostalgic when there's really not anyone around left to feel nostalgic about silent movies, you know, since that was so long ago?
Hey, Sonny. What are you talking about?
Well, Stephen Becker, you definitely wanted to talk about Mission Impossible. And what are we on now? Number three? Four?
Number three.
Four.
Four. You're right. Sorry. 12. Yeah. And then. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on here. For one thing, they're doing an interesting release schedule where they're releasing it next Friday on IMAX only, and then it goes into a wider audience the week after.
Part of that is because they're also going to show 5 minutes of footage from the next Batman film. So it's a big kind of marketing effort for Warner Brothers.
So if you see the IMAX in advance, are you allowed to write about the regular one?
Yeah, but I think you have to write that you're writing about IMAX every time. But,
gotcha.
Yeah, but what I'm interested in, you know, Chris Wagner and I were talking about this the other day, and that it's a really interesting plopping this just straightforward action movie right in the middle of all of the prestige holiday movies. And I think it's actually kind of a smart idea because there are some people who just still want to go and see a movie just to lay back and, you know, let it kind of wash over you like something like Mission Impossible will inevitably do. And so I think the timing of it's really smart. The other thing that we are interested in is that it's directed by Brad Bird, who was the director of Ratatouille and The Incredibles, two really good animated movies. And so I'm interested to see how he's going to do with a big screen action movie.
Stephen Becker and Chris Wagner and Christopher Kelly are my guests. We are talking about holiday season movies this year. If you would like to join us, ask a question, weigh in with an opinion about something we've discussed already, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Also, remember to check out Becker and Wagner's weekly KERA movie podcast, The Big Screen, at artandseek.net.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are speaking this hour with our three movie critics, Stephen Becker of KERA's Art and Seek, Chris Wagner of the Dallas Morning News, and Christopher Kelly of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. If you'd like to join our conversation about 2011 holiday season movies, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, let's talk about young adult. This is Charlize. Is it Theron? Theron?
Guys, I always say Theron.
Yeah, that's how I always say it, but I've heard it both ways.
This is the monster lady in a comedy.
Yes.
We've known that she could do comedy because she did Arrested Development and some other things.
She's done lighter stuff before.
And this is from the director, the screenwriter of Juno? Is that right?
Both Jason Reitman, the director, and Diablo Cody, the screenwriter.
Yeah, and Jason Reitman also has directed Up in the Air a few years ago.
And Thank You for Smoking.
Thank You for Smoking. So pretty good track record for him.
It's an interesting film. It's going to be I think it's going to be a little bit of a tough sell. It's a very unlikable character. And
She's an alcoholic. She writes like teen fiction.
She writes young adult fiction. She's just very bitter and vindictive and unhappy. Her life peaked in high school and she goes back to her small hometown to try to bust up her old flame's marriage, to sort of reclaim this part of herself that represented when her life was good. I saw it. I'm going to see it again. It's a very unusual film. It's a very unredeeming protagonist.
Bad Santa?
It doesn't go for those big, broad laughs like Bad Santa does. Bad Santa was sort of carnival-esque in a way. This is, in its own way, very subtle. I'm wondering what audiences are going to make of it. I'm still wondering what I made of it, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again. Actually, I admire Reitman's chutzpah for making this movie when he's on such a roll. He's sort of exercising his right to make something different based on what he's done before. And I think when a filmmaker has developed a track record, I think that's one of the advantages that filmmaker has at that point.
What does Patton Oswalt do?
Patton Oswalt plays a guy who she went to high school with. Mavis Gary is Theron's character. They develop a sort of odd friendship, an odd relationship. He's sort of our eyes and ears for the movie. He's the one that's looking at this character going, wow, this woman is really messed up. So we can sort of say that for ourselves. He's actually very good. He's one of the better parts of the film. So I hate to be so equivocal about it, but it caught me off guard. I actually wrote about it for this Sunday, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
Circling back to the point you were making about her being an unlikable character, I think there's kind of an interesting thing going on in the psyche of the moviegoer, which is, you know, we'll go see Charlize Theron as a murderer and monster, but if she's a mean person, then that may not attract us, which is kind of, I don't know what that says about us, that we're accepting of a killer, but not someone who's just kind of rude.
I'm not sure how many people actually saw Monster, though. I mean, the Academy certainly did, and the critics loved it. The industry loved it. I don't think Monster did Monster box office. So, but I know what you mean. Monster, she uglied herself up, and she put on a lot of weight, and she put on a lot of scar tissue makeup, and sort of did what people often do to get Oscars these days. And yeah, it is a much different kind of role.
Well, and there's also an element where you have Charlize Theron, who is clearly, you know, someone who's has Hollywood looks, and there's a certain amount of the population who want to hate someone like her already. And then when they see that she plays someone unlikable in a movie, that's kind of like extra ammo, I guess.
And I think that's right. Reitman commented on that a little bit, that he's hoping that people will look up on the screen and see somebody that's perhaps as flawed as they are. So, and that's part of the appeal of an unlikable character sometimes.
Yet much more attractive.
There is that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have John on the line in Arlington. Hey, John.
Hey, guys. I wanted to get with you, since I love whenever you have a bunch of critics that, you know, you kind of follow around the Metroplex for opinions. And even though we're talking about new movies coming out and how excited we are, is there any movies that you guys think, like, in the last, I'd say, like, just like the last 5 years or 10 years, that you think is like the quintessential holiday movie? Like, obviously, It's a Wonderful Life and all these older movies, but do you think anything really stands out?
That's actually a really good question.
That's a good question.
I know my vote, but I'm not a critic.
What's your vote? What's your
Elf.
Okay.
It's a silly movie, but I can watch it every year and still laugh at the four elf food groups.
I watch it just about every year myself.
I'm a really big Bad Santa fan. It's obviously not the quintessential holiday movie, but I think that's a movie that had the strength of its bad convictions, and it was very funny in a broad way.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Yeah,
I can't think of it. Most of them have been kind of bad, like that Tim Allen one. The
Santa Claus?
No, Christmas with the Cranks.
Oh, right.
There was that Four Christmases that was pretty bad.
Terrible, yeah. No.
This year we've got New Year's Eve.
Which, oh, I saw New Year's Eve.
You did?
That was bad.
Okay.
Did you guys see Arthur Christmas?
I haven't seen Arthur Christmas. That's from the Wallace and Gromit people, right?
That should be something.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Harold and Kumar Christmas. There's been a couple this year that I'm behind
on. I hear
on.
That's really good. I heard that's, for the most part, I've really enjoyed the Harold and Kumar movies.
And that one's in 3D as well.
Wow.
Everything's in 3D.
Now. I'm guessing you have the munchies while you watch that, and you just get like the extra large tub of popcorn and
I think just,
goat it down.
This just speaks to the small hearts that movie critics have, because we don't, we clearly don't like holiday movies.
You're a mean one, there clearly is
room for somebody to come and make
a modern,
you know, the next Christmas Story or Elf or something like that.
I'm sure, but we must be forgetting something.
So is the new Muppets not a Christmas movie or not a holiday season movie?
It's a wonderful movie, yeah. but it's not a holiday movie per se, but it's the kind of movie I love to see during the holidays because it's so full of exuberance, charm, music.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia, comedy. I mean, it really is a comforting, and especially for people of our age group, we will not say what that is, but especially people who kind of grew up on The Muppets. I mean, it's just pure comfort food. It's just a delight.
I think people know our age group.
I think people in our age group who have kids will like it more than their kids, I think.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
I was excited to read that Brett McKenzie did the music or some of the
which is probably going to win the Oscar from the guy from Flight of the Conchords. Mm-hmm. And it's just so witty. It manages to be kind of winkingly postmodern and also really exuberant and charming and emotional at the same time. And that's a feat. That's hard to do.
And I do think the songs in that movie are going to be competing with each other for those Oscar nominations. Mm-hmm. The songs are that strong.
So you guys, none of the three of you has kids. Do you take a kid with you when you review a movie like this to check out their reaction?
I tend to find a small child and rent him.
The studio should just start issuing you one as you go into
You know, critics get this a lot, and I actually think if a movie can succeed, I actually think you shouldn't take a kid, because mm-hmm. I think if a movie can succeed in unlocking the inner kid in an adult, as The Muppets did, as Finding Nemo, Ratatouille, rattle off your list of Pixar movies.
Shame. And really, it's not a long list of the kids' movies made.
But those are the ones. Mm-hmm. Those are really the ones that stick with people and that have meaning. I mean, kids are probably going to like a lot more things. And yeah, that's fine. I mean, if you're just looking for a movie to take the kids to, Puss in Boots is fine. But it's not going to, you know, hit you on that kind of emotional level. And those are the classics, you know. So I think a kid would corrupt my objective.
They do that.
Anybody seen The Iron Lady? This is Meryl Streep as Margaret Thatcher.
They've kept this under wraps for us thus far.
Yeah,
they've really embargoed
that. Yeah, and I don't even think they're going to release it here until early January. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they're waiting. So I'm assuming that they must be doing some kind of Oscar qualifying run of it in New York and
yes,
LA.
Absolutely.
Basically, the rules to be Oscar eligible is you have to have a 1 week run somewhere. So it'll show somewhere at the last week of December, and then I guess it'll trickle down to us.
I think it's actually an Oscar strategy, because I think in years past, Meryl Streep has been the front runner and allowed to be eclipsed. Mm-hmm. And so now I think they're like, well, maybe let's let people like Viola Davis be the front runner, and then we'll bring Meryl in right at the end and have her kind of take over the story.
Stealth Streep.
It's been a while since she's had an Oscar, hasn't it?
It's been 20, 30 years. Yeah, yeah. Sophie's Choice.
She's been nominated many times.
Yeah, she's eminently overdue, and it sounds like this could be the thing that puts her over the top.
It's looking like her or Davis at this point, right? For the help.
For the help, Davis. Yeah.
You just have to wonder if Meryl Streep can manage the accent. I'm just kidding. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. There's this new phrase out there to describe the way action films are shot. It's called chaos. It's called chaos cinema. And I was wondering if you guys, it sort of calls out a lot of the directors and their seeming ability to direct a coherent action sequence. I was wondering if you guys have any thoughts on not only the new phrase, but the way action films are shot these days. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
It's so new, I've never heard
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I wonder if what he means is that really handheld,
like shaky,
very tight to the action style.
My sense actually is what he might mean is the Michael Bay style, where there's often no establishing shots, and it just starts jumbles the scenes together, and it's this rapid-fire kind of kinetic style of editing. And that really has kind of taken over in a lot of the mainstream action movies, but...
As well as Baz Luhrmann movies.
I become carsick at those movies with the handheld camera for minutes on end.
Well, and it's unnecessary. I mean, I understand they're trying to put you right in the scene as close as you can be, but that wobbly camera angle just makes me crazy.
Put me there with a steady camera.
Yeah, all of those Jason Bourne movies had that, and that was the one thing I didn't like about those.
But the last Transformers movie turned that into kind of like an opera of just frenzy and chaos. I mean, there's an art to that. It's hard to watch sometimes, but there is...
It can be done well.
Yeah, it can be done. And I do like the Bourne movies. I think those are the real great examples of that.
I tend to be more of a long, lush camera take kind of guy, but there are certain films that I think are chopped up very nicely and have that sort of immediacy. And I have the advantage of not getting car sick at movies. I know a lot of people do, though.
It's awful, actually.
I'm sure it is.
I thought the Harry Potter movie this year kind of did both very well. You know, it had some really elegant... longer take sequences and then had some really, you know, rapid fire action sequences. And I thought that was a very intriguing mix.
I want to drop in this email. We have an email from Elizabeth who says Love Actually is a great Christmas movie.
Mm. So, yeah.
For anybody looking for something to rent. I had three people going, eh.
Well, I haven't seen it.
You know, I've never seen Love Actually. Wow.
Nope. In a way, I've seen it. It's a little bit of a precursor to these New Year's Day and Valentine's Day movies where there's about, I don't know, a dozen characters in it, and then we kind of bounce back and forth.
Is that the Hugh Grant one,
stories.
Where he's the president or the prime minister?
Yeah, basically every British actor you've heard of is in that movie.
That Hollywood likes making these movies because they don't need to do a lot of work. Like, you don't really need to develop much of a screenplay. The actors show up for 2 or 3 days apiece, and you have this very marketable thing with a lot of A-list names, but... they don't always make for very satisfying or coherent movies, which is really the case for New Year's Eve.
I saw a great tweet last night that Gary Marshall is probably horrible on Twitter because he can't say anything with less than 140 characters.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Bruce on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bruce.
Hi there. First, just got to tell you, I thought Love Actually was super coherent. It all tied up extremely well. In fact, it impressed me how well it tied up.
Okay.
I thought that was a very entertaining movie. I tuned in late. I don't know if you guys have talked about Melancholia.
We have not.
But or if you plan to, but I just saw that night before last and was duly impressed on a bunch of different levels. I'm surprised. Do you guys not think that Kirsten Dunst has any hope of a nomination for that role?
She'll get nominated, probably. I don't think she's going to win. But, yeah, she'll probably get nominated. It's a good comeback story as well. I know Chris Kelly and I are divided on this one. I actually liked it quite a bit. I thought it had sort of an ecstatic, near-religious quality to it. And I'm not a huge Lars von Trier fan, and Chris Kelly is a big Lars von Trier fan.
It's funny to watch you two during that call because you look like a tragedy in a comedy mask.
you know, my line on this is a movie for people who don't like Lars von Trier movies.
That's me.
He makes these crazy, bold, outrageous movies. This one is oddly restrained and tame, and it's a portrait of the apocalypse that takes so long to get through the apocalypse that I wanted, you know, a boulder to fall on me by the end. I found it so pretentious and funereal and lugubrious and all those sort of words that mean exaggerated and pretentiously emotional and gloomy. I hated everything about it, and I thought Kirsten Dunst moped her way through the movie. The critical response to this movie is the most mystifying of any movie for me this year.
I thought she did a really great job of being just completely spiritually drained. I haven't seen many performers.
Come to my house any night.
Well. Come to the Kelly household for Thanksgiving if you want to see spiritual
draining. Spiritual draining provided to all guests. Hey, can you break the tie here, Steve?
Well, yeah, and I think I'm going to side on the like side, which is that with a caveat, which is that as I was watching it, I was really kind of sitting there thinking, where is this going? What is going on here? And it really took all the way till the very end for me to kind of put it all together and really and sort of grasp the themes and ideas that von Trier is trying to put across in the movie. And really, it's a movie about people dealing with dread in different ways, because there's about three or four main characters in the movie, and they're all kind of on different spots on the timeline of this idea that the Earth may end. And it's how they, and so watching them come to that acceptance or denial or acceptance and then denial, that makes the movie interesting.
They should have brought an Albie Singer from Annie Hall to say the universe is expanding just to top it all off.
Is there any way to compare it with, like, The Road from a couple years ago?
They're both unrelenting and miserable and depressing. I guess that would be the comparison.
I wanted to make you say lugubrious again.
It's much. I think it's much more of an art film than The Road was. It's much less linear and straightforward for me, anyway.
Don't you think the comparison is The Tree of Life? Actually, I mean, these movies that really are trying to literally reach for the cosmos. You know, I mean, connect a very intimate human experience with a very grand and kind of cosmological experience. I didn't really think Tree of Life worked, but I thought that came off a little better than Melancholia.
Actually, I think the most literal analogy is probably Another Earth, another movie
That's
in which there is indeed another planet.
I
that
somehow
pops
missed
up.
That, and I wanted to see it. Was it good?
I enjoyed it. It was pretty small. It's pretty modest. But yeah, I thought it was really intriguing. I thought it was a well-told, subtle story with, I thought, a really good performance in the middle of it from a new actress, Britt Marling. Is that her name? Mm-hmm.
Is it out on video yet?
I think it will be about to be in the next few weeks.
Great. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Kay on the line in Arlington. Hey, Kay.
Hi, how are y'all today?
Great, thank you.
I wanted to ask about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Great cast, but it doesn't seem to be opening anywhere in this area.
It will.
It's open tomorrow. Have any of y'all seen it? What do you think?
Have we all seen it?
I have not.
Okay, but you will soon.
Am I the only one? Have you read the book?
I have not read the book.
I have not read the book.
But I'm the
either.
Only one who's read the book.
And
so.
I have not seen the much praised Alec Guinness miniseries either, which I would love
Stephen,
to
if,
do.
If you've read the book, maybe we can sit and watch it together and you can explain to me what on earth is going on.
Yeah, can you tell us what happens?
So just
no spoilers.
Yeah. Head-scratching, confusing movie.
It's a confusing book as well, but that's also sort of the joy of reading the book, is that you're always kind of thinking, you're just on the edge of fully understanding what's happening. That can be really frustrating in a movie, though.
I was on the edge of just leaving the theater. I was so frustrated.
That's another one that I feel like I need to give another look to, because I was scratching my head, but I could tell that there was a lot there, and it was confusing, but I think there's a good chance I was tired that day as well.
We will talk more about movies with Chris Vogner, Christopher Kelly, and Stephen Becker after the break. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Chris Vogner of the Dallas Morning News, Christopher Kelly of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and Stephen Becker of KERA's Art and Seek. We're talking about holiday season movies, not specifically holiday movies necessarily. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So I have to tell you, although I have not seen it, I'm curious about The Descendants, because it seems like a very different kind of role for George Clooney.
It's fairly different. Some people don't quite buy him as someone this downtrodden. I thought it worked. It's one of my favorite movies this year. I love the story. I'm a big Alexander Payne fan. I think he's mastered those hairpin emotional turns.
He's the sideways guy, right?
Sideways, About Schmidt, Citizen Ruth, and what am I forgetting?
Election.
Thank you very much. So I am a very big Descendants fan. I am on Team Descendants.
The Descendants is actually probably number one on my list right now, waiting to be knocked off, maybe by something else. But
it sounds very violent.
Yes. Well, I really did buy Clooney in the role. I think Clooney has become such a better actor in the last maybe 4 or 5 years because he's allowed himself to be vulnerable on screen, which is something that someone, say, like we always mention Tom Cruise, doesn't normally do, you know. But there are moments in The Descendants, which, if you don't know, it's about a guy whose wife goes into a coma after having an accident, and he's sort of left to care for his two young kids. And then I don't want to give it away, but he finds out a little something about his relationship with his wife that changes the terms of things, and he's kind of coming to terms with that.
Artfully done.
Yeah, well, you know.
That's impressive. I would have spoiled it.
Yeah, well, glad I took – anyway, and it all takes place in Hawaii, so that's sort of nice as well. But Alexander Payne has really managed to also straddle these very emotional moments with actually a lot of comedy in this movie. And I think the comedic moments are all the more funny because they're alongside all of these kind of tough moments. So you're wanting to laugh, and he gives you an opportunity to laugh like right when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought it really worked well for me.
Chris Kelly, can we make it a hat trick?
Yeah, it's a good movie.
That's it?
That is all.
We should mention that it opened the Lone Star International Film Festival in Fort Worth this year. So kudos to those guys for picking a good opening night movie.
I think you're going to throw things at me, but there's not much on your side of the desk. Has anyone seen the new Twilight, and how does it compare with the other Twilights?
I finally cried uncle on the Twilight series, and then I find out this one's apparently a little better than the other ones.
I would never throw anything at you, Chris, but no, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I've seen the first two and not seen this one. So
I saw the first two as well. I kind of liked the first one. I haven't read any of the books. Mm-hmm. I am not in the Twilight demographic. I thought the
you're
first
not a 12-year-old girl. Yeah,
not that I know of. I liked the first one just as a movie, mm-hmm. actually, as a story, and I thought the second one was horrible. And I've been lucky enough to have somebody else on staff who's really interested in the Twilight series who wants to write about them.
So lots of people want to keep talking about Christmas movies, so
okay.
We'll talk about
sure.
this a little bit. Jay says, favorite Christmas movie ever, The Gremlins, 1984.
Gremlins is a great movie, and
good call.
I kind of forgot that it was a Christmas movie. It's been so long.
That brought to mind Die Hard, which is another genre movie that takes place at Christmas and has become kind of a Christmas classic in a weird way. It somehow evokes the spirit of Christmas. I don't know. Maybe it's Bruce Willis cursing and
Christmas
blowing things
makes
up.
Me want to pick up a machine.
I like the message of that
away.
Film that he is healed enough to kill again.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Well, he reunites with his wife and blows up a few buildings. That's what we all want to do, I think,
yeah,
around
we mentioned
the holidays.
Love Actually earlier, and Alan Rickman's in both Love Actually and
there you go.
Die Hard, so I guess he's the king of Christmas movies.
Laura says, Love Actually equals yuck.
Good for you, Laura. You have good taste.
Good Christmas movie she recommends, Remember the Night, with Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, blah, blah, blah. So we're stretching back. My favorite old movie is Meet Me in St. Louis.
That's a beautiful film.
You can sing along.
Yeah, the color is just so fantastic, mm-hmm. and Judy Garland is amazing. Just came out on Blu-ray, actually.
Oh, yeah, really?
Looks splendid.
Might have to pick up a copy of that.
Can you do your version of the trolley song for us, or is that asking?
Probably.
That'd be a Christmas gift for me if you did that.
Can you cry like Margaret O'Brien?
Have yourself.
All right, let's go back to the phones now.
Yes, please.
We have Emily on the line in Hearst. Hey, Emily.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
I'm really enjoying this conversation, guys.
Thank you.
I just wanted to give a couple of my favorite Christmas movies over the years, and some of these are kind of old. One of them is When Harry Met Sally, which I think you probably either love it or hate it. Another one, Home Alone. And probably my most favorite, which most people probably don't think of as a Christmas movie, The Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, sure.
I don't think of any of those three films as Christmas movies.
Well, When Harry Met Sally kind of conclude the big the
New
the
Year's at the
climax
end,
climax
right?
is at New Year's, yeah.
It's funny. Christmas is the backdrop for so many good movies that you don't instinctively think of necessarily as a Christmas movie. I mean, Die Hard, who would think of that as a Christmas movie?
She did make me think of The Ref, which is Christmas night.
Dennis Leary
and Judy Davis and Kevin Spacey. Yeah. Terrific, underrated movie from the 90s. So, yeah, it's interesting how filmmakers, it's just that go-to backdrop for people.
And even in a sense, It's a Wonderful Life. Is that really a Christmas movie, or is it a movie about a guy having a terrible crisis that takes place during the holidays?
Another one we haven't mentioned yet that's one of my favorites is Christmas Vacation, which is probably 20-something years old at this point. But it's one of those ones when it comes on TV, I end up getting locked in.
I think everybody knows somebody whose dad does the lights.
Well, I was just about to say, I do the lights on our house, and I think about that scene every time I do it.
We haven't talked about Tintin. Have you guys seen that yet?
No,
we
tried to see it yesterday, and there was a projection malfunction, so it's been rescheduled. But I think Chris and I both thought the opening credits looked fantastic.
Credits are awesome.
I just saw a trailer for it, and it just seems like a feast visually.
Well, Spielberg has two movies coming out this year.
Within days of each other.
He also has War Horse, which I really did not care for. War Horse is a very bloated, bombastic, sentimental movie. When people apply the worst adjectives that they can think of towards Spielberg. This is the kind of movie they're thinking of. It's like Always or really one of his lesser efforts. So I'm hoping the energy got directed into Tintin and it's got a little more life than I think War Horse does.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Christopher Kelly, the Fort Worth star.
I love Spielberg. Spielberg's one of my favorite directors, but when he misses hard. And War Horse, I just thought, missed from start to finish.
I haven't seen it yet. So.
Side note here, what do you guys think about Once being made into a Broadway musical?
I'm glad you mentioned that because the New York Times had a story about that on Sunday. I think it's a great idea. Once was actually my number one movie of whatever year that came out, 2007
two years,
or something.
Yeah.
I love that movie. In fact, that's one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. And I'm kind of surprised that it took this long. Now that I think about it, it's like, oh, no duh, because not only does it have great songs in it, but it's something that would be easily adaptable to the stage. These people all the action takes places just in, you know, houses or on the streets, very easy things to stage. So I really hope that the musical is good because I want it to come here.
It's interesting that I actually just saw the Bonnie and Clyde musical that premiered on Broadway last week, and there's you look at what's being adapted to the stage, there's going to be a version of Giant that's playing here at the Dallas Theater Center, which is having its premiere here. All of these properties, they're trying to kind of find new ways to make money out of them. And when they work, and I think Once probably could work for the reasons Stevens said, it's fun, it's interesting. But when they don't work, it often seems like a train wreck.
It's funny though. Is it just me, or did it used to go the other way, mm-hmm. that things would start out on Broadway and mm-hmm. then they would be made into a movie? And now there are so many things. There's a Broadway musical of Newsies out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Newsies, yeah.
That's a really good feature story idea. I might have to steal that.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Feel free not to credit me. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Anne in Dallas. Hey, Anne.
I am so enjoying this. I came late to the discussion. But a couple of things. One thing, Kirsten Dunst, I'm not a big fan of hers. I just don't think she's a good actress. Charlize, I loved her in Monster because for some reason, even though she was a serial killer, you just really felt for her, you know? One question I have for you is usually around the holidays, there's some cheese ball movie that has an African-American cast in it, and it's usually horrible. I was wondering if you guys knew if there was any kind of, like, primarily African-American cast movie that was coming out during the holiday season.
The only thing I can think of is Pariah, which does not sound cheeseballish at all.
Definitely not cheeseball.
Well,
actually.
There was a stretch of movies like Nothing Like the Holidays and This Christmas, where it was like all of a sudden Hollywood discovered there was a Latino audience and a black audience, and so they rushed to make movies for Christmas for those audiences. But this year, I don't think there's much coming down the pike.
I can't think of one offhand. I mean, Tyler Perry has one coming out next month, I think. But I don't think that's going to be out in time for Christmas.
And they typically don't screen the Tyler Perry movies for critics ahead of time either.
Nope.
But Pariah, which is, as Stephen mentioned, yeah, excellent, African-American themed movie about a young teenage girl who is coming to terms with her sexuality in Brooklyn, and a really fine movie, very, very worth seeing.
Here next month, right?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jeremy in Dallas. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
First, just want to second Elf is a great Christmas holiday movie. It is to Christmas what I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is to Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great call there. My question is for the guys there is, what do they feel about a movie that I think falls in the category of didn't need to be remade, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Well, we talked about this a little off the top.
Okay.
It's embargoed.
Yes.
People keep saying that it didn't need to be remade because there's this brilliant Swedish version. The Swedish version is fine. Like, it's an accomplished effort, but I think there's a lot to be said for having one of Hollywood's finest technicians right now, David Fincher, tackle this very interesting material. So I get kind of angry when people hold up the Swedish movie as the, you know, be all end all.
Does
it was good.
Does it break the embargo to say that I like the new one better than the original?
Yeah. Well, if you're breaking the embargo, I will say I like the new one better than the original too.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of that, and I will say I'm the one who hasn't seen the new one. I have seen the Swedish one, and I bet you the main difference is that there's probably a lot more money thrown at this new one, because I've seen the trailer and a very long version of the trailer, and it just looked amazing. So a lot of money can help it look good.
There's just this bias against American remakes of foreign films. Sometimes it's, you know, I mean, this isn't the most sacrosanct material. I mean, it's a pulpy, you know, it's a trashy airport bestseller. I mean, why not have a really interesting director like Fincher, who talked about it in those terms? He talked about it like The Godfather or something. Like, let's take do what Coppola did and take a pulp novel and try to raise it to its artistic heights. So.
There's something to be said for Hollywood budget. There's something to be said for Hollywood technicians with all of that resource being thrown at a project. And yeah, they do sometimes mess up European films, but they don't always.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there some big costume drama this year?
Oh,
I can't believe we haven't talked about any costume dramas.
Let's see.
A Dangerous Method is a little costumey.
Well, there's Coriolanus, which is the Ralph Fiennes directed modernization of the Shakespeare play,
which is awesome,
which is very well done. A kind of action movie Hurt Locker treatment of Shakespeare, which is a lot of fun.
Again, next month here, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These all open kind of for 1 week in New York and LA to qualify for the Oscars and eventually trickle their way here.
Yeah, Coriolanus is fantastic.
Very well done.
One of my favorites of the year.
And I like Dangerous Method, which is the Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung biopic in which they sort of square off again over this totally insane patient played by Keira Knightley, whose performance has been very divisive.
Yeah, I really like The Dangerous Method too. Cronenberg's intellect is just so formidable, and it kind of I have trouble keeping up with exactly what he's doing with the character dynamics, and he's playing with these huge ideas related to psychoanalysis, and so I really enjoyed it. I think some of it might have gone a wee bit over the highest hair on my head, but I still really, really liked it.
When we talked earlier about director and actor relationships, the Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen one is growing. They did A History of Violence together and Eastern Promises, two movies that were both very good, unlike A Dangerous Method, which it was all I could do to stay awake for an hour and a half. And even when I was – anyway, I just thought it was incredibly talky.
It's very talky.
And
it's
the
very
talkiness – And the conversation wasn't interesting.
I think it's very interesting.
That's been a common reaction. It seems to either be a love it or hate a proposition. You either get into it or you are bored out of your skull. I think if you do find these kind of issues of psychoanalysis and the birth of psychoanalysis interesting, you'll go for it. And I loved Keira Knightley, who gesticulates wildly and a crazy over-the-top performance, and I couldn't take my eyes off her. I thought she was terrific.
There are times when she almost looks like the werewolf in American Werewolf in London, where she sticks out her chin.
Her jaws just jutted
jaw
out.
So
yeah.
Far. The other fascinating thing to me about A Dangerous Method is that so many of Cronenberg's early horror movies are basically Freudian manuals kind of come to life, very graphic, nasty, bodily horror movies. This is sort of the more casual, conversational, drawing room version of movies like Shivers, for instance, or The Brood. Somewhat obscure, but well worth checking out David Cronenberg films.
Well, we will have to leave it there. We have had this hour Chris Wagner for the Dallas Morning News, who writes about arts and entertainment for the Dallas Morning News, Christopher Kelly of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and Stephen Becker from KERA's Art and Seek. You can check out Becker and Wagner's weekly KERA movie podcast, The Big Screen, at artandseek.net. Guys, it is always great to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Our senior producer is Jeff Whitting. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download that free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.